It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. As Republicans in the Assembly put forth a proposal to legalize non-smokable medical marijuana through state-run dispensaries, we get reaction to the plan, and you can be part of the conversation. Call in with a question, share thoughts, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Lucas Rickert is a historian of medicine and pharmacy, professor at the UW-Madison School of Pharmacy, and executive director of the American Institute of the History of Pharmacy that's based at UW-Madison. Luke, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for the invitation.
Well, let's just establish where you come from on this issue right away. Should Wisconsin legalize marijuana for medical purposes?
I've been studying and writing about cannabis as a medicine, as well as a personal use substance, for over a decade now. My opinions have really sort of evolved over that time. I started out with this sort of research interest while I was in the province of Saskatchewan in Canada. And, you know, over a decade ago, the province was home to the country's sole manufacturer of medical cannabis. So Saskatchewan was producing all the medical cannabis across the country. And that's what got me interested in cannabis and medicine and how people got themselves access to it, which is a roundabout way of saying this is super intriguing. And I do feel like this is a positive step in the right direction for patients in the state of Wisconsin.
I wonder, though, would the pharmacy profession that you're in view this issue and this debate of medical marijuana any differently than other areas of the healthcare field, like, you know, primary care or palliative care?
I think many of my colleagues in pharmacy, and, you know, I'm not a health professional, I'm a social scientist and historian, but I think that many of them would sort of get behind the idea that they should be on the front lines in helping dispense and treat patients with medical cannabis if that's what happens and the bill moves forward. I think that they'd really, really want to sort of have a say in getting patients the best treatment possible.
Republican Assembly Speaker Robin Voss told WISN-TV's Upfront that this proposal would probably be the most restrictive version in the entire country.
We are not going to have something like other states do where you can walk in and say, I don't feel well, and they give you a gummy bear, right? So it's going to be much more limited than that.
So, Luke, is Wisconsin's proposal stricter than what other states allow?
The answer is yes, but we also have to remember it's really early days with the bill. I mean, we need to remember that a lot of the details could change once the negotiation starts. So we've heard a lot about five dispensaries across the state that are run through the state. And we've also heard a lot about fairly limited number of medical conditions built into this the piece of legislation. For example, the bill specifies there's no inhalables. But my point is that some of these details could change once the senators and the representatives really started getting to, you know, elbow to elbow and eyeball to eyeball.
Let's pick up on one of those details you just said, that the proposal calls for the state to operate dispensaries to dispense the drug. And these dispensaries would each include a pharmacist employed by Wisconsin to write prescriptions. Is this kind of setup unique?
So the idea of putting pharmacists there on the front line to assist is unique. One point of clarification, that there's only a couple of federally approved cannabis medicines out there. One is Epidiolex. And so basically, the patients who are getting access to the medical cannabis would be certified or authorized, but they wouldn't have a prescription in the sort of technical sense of the word, because we're in a funny old place right now, honestly, because at the federal level, cannabis is still Schedule One, meaning that it doesn't have any medical applications according to sort of the language of Schedule One. But then at the state level, More than two-thirds of the states have moved forward with medical cannabis plans for a variety of different conditions. So there's this tension that we have to recognize. And I just would circle back and say that putting pharmacists, who are really the experts on dosage forms and drug-drug interactions, putting them out front, I think, is really a clever thing to do because they are the experts.
Talking about a new Republican proposal in Wisconsin to legalize medical marijuana, Luke Rickert is with us, historian of medicine and pharmacy at UW-Madison. And you can join the conversation, call in with a question. You can share your thoughts, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Luke, can you step back for a moment? What types of ailments or diseases is marijuana helpful in treating?
Yeah, sure. I could take a step back, no problem. One thing I wanted to just sort of highlight is that, I mean, we're talking about a process of re-medicalization of cannabis, not purely medicalization. And what I mean by that is, I mean, Western-based science and medicine has known about the medical value of cannabis for over 200 years. And 200 years ago, cannabis was used for a host of different ailments, whether or not it was chronic coughs or pain associated with childbirth, a variety of different issues. And now what we're dealing with is, a variety of different ailments, again, related to epilepsy, seizures, pain reduction. And what you see, at least in some states like Illinois, they have a list of 50 plus conditions that they use medical cannabis for versus the 15 plus, or maybe it's, I think it's 15 that we've decided to put into this bill. So I think that gives you a sense of sort of the long sort of durée, the long history of cannabis in the United States and how it's been used for a good long while.
When you see that the Food and Drug Administration has approved one cannabis-derived drug and three synthetic cannabis-related drugs for prescription use, why aren't these existing medications sufficient to treat medical conditions?
So they have very specific, so I think what you're referencing is Epidiolex, and so it's been used for and approved for the treatment of seizures and other severe forms of epilepsy. And then you have synthetic THC in Marinol and Syndros. And remember, Kate, that I'm not a pharmacist or doctor here. But what they've got, in addition, what medical cannabis the industry has created is a number of other THC and CBD supplements and products in addition to those federally approved. And these are for conditions related to nausea and vomiting or chronic pain, like I said, multiple sclerosis, or even for loss of appetite. And so it really runs the gamut with the federally approved and then the non-federally approved medical cannabis products that are available to us.
Luke Rickert is a UW-Madison School of Pharmacy professor, leads the American Institute of the History of Pharmacy as we discuss a potential legislative roadmap in Wisconsin for legalizing aspects of medical marijuana. Be part of the discussion. You can call in with a question, add your viewpoint, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We discuss a restrictive medical marijuana bill circulating in the legislature and get historical perspective on the evolving nature of legal and illegal substances. Luke Rickert is a UW-Madison Pharmacy School professor, executive director of the American Institute of the History of Pharmacy. You can be part of the discussion. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234. Let's go to Kay in Madison. Hi, Kay. Go ahead.
Hi. I was born severely premature, and that had consequences for my body. So I pay attention to baby issues. And years ago, as I recall, when Colorado opened up marijuana use, studies were done on newborn babies whose mothers had smoked marijuana. And the results showed that the marijuana smoke never left the cells of the babies. And whereas otherwise cigarette smoke, for instance, goes through urine. And I knew someone who smoked marijuana for 20 years. He was a complete noodlehead. And every time in the summertime he walked into somebody's house, he would start throwing open the windows because he was so hot. I don't think the smoke ever left his system. And so they don't know what this has done to newborn babies.
Okay, let's hear from Luke on what research has been done or any inroads there. Luke, go ahead.
Sure, yeah. I just want to say thanks to Kay for that. I think she's pointing towards a valuable issue, which is there hasn't been enough concrete research been done on the effects of cannabis on the brain. And that's one of the elements that I think that is going to require future study. Luckily, the National Institutes of Health has become more receptive and more accepting of neurological studies and more physiological studies of cannabis in the future. And so I think that, you know, a good point's being raised there.
The Republican proposal would prohibit smokable cannabis products to be distributed in Wisconsin. And through our reporting here at WPR, would allow only edibles and oils. How does the way marijuana is consumed affect treatment?
So, I mean, take this with a grain of salt, because, of course, I'm not a doctor or pharmacist, Kate. But, I mean, there is a lot of evidence out there that suggests that inhalation is not as effective as getting the medicine into the system as either the oils or the or other edibles, and then of course you have sort of the lung damage that comes with the inhalable products. That's, you know, this piece of the bill itself sort of, you know, sets it apart from other states which don't have the sort of restriction. But I would honestly leave that to the medical professionals.
Well, let me ask you this, though. As you look at other states, are doses for medical purposes typically lower than what is used recreationally?
I mean, dosing is hugely variable.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, and one of the things I suppose, you know, I would say is that, I mean, since 96, you know, California was the first state to legalize cannabis for medical purposes. And then that was followed by Oregon and Washington and Alaska and you know, a number of other states. And, you know, we've gotten to this point where medical cannabis programs across the country have evolved in various different ways. So we have over two-thirds of the states have approved cannabis legislation, more than 12 states having recreational and medicinal programs. So I guess if I could say anything about this bill, it's that the legislators have a lot of different lessons that they can draw on from across the country.
Let's bring in Jeff in Delafield now. Jeff, hi. What would you like to share?
Yes, good morning. Thank you. Any of these proposals for medicinal marijuana really concern me that, and maybe not intended originally, but invariably they seem to become just a pathway towards full legalization. And that's a huge concern to me, because there are studies out there that show significantly increased societal costs in states that have gone to full legalization of marijuana. And I understand the medicinal use, but I don't think I got a clear answer of why existing pharmaceuticals don't serve the same purpose. I also understand that marijuana has been used medicinally for probably thousands of years, but I'll point out our society is different today. I don't know that it can handle something such as marijuana used medicinally. It's just there's too much abuse and too much cost to society, too much potential for cost to society. So this really concerns me, and that's my comment. Thank you.
Jeff, thank you for calling in. Luke, what comes up for you when you hear that?
Yeah, I think it's completely valid and valuable as an opinion. I would add to what Jeff is saying in suggesting that, while there is concerns about dependence with medical cannabis and personal use cannabis, it doesn't have the same sort of safety or risk profile as other opioids. And, you know, we've seen over the past decade and some a severe opioid crisis across the country. And we've seen this leakage from the medical realm into sort of the recreational realm. And it's, cost a lot of lives and caused a lot of suffering. And, you know, medical cannabis, while the research is still being developed, might be a better alternative to, strictly the opioids. I just add one other thing too, which is that there could very well be benefits for people in Wisconsin, taxation benefits, business benefits. The idea of implementing a medical cannabis program, and perhaps in the future even a limited personal use program, could help with taxation, keep dollars in the state of Wisconsin, and so those are other elements I think of sort of an evolving story here in the state.
Luke Rickert, historian of medicine and pharmacy at UW-Madison, as we look at a proposal, new Republican proposal to legalize medical marijuana. And your thoughts are welcome. Questions as well, 800-642-1234. Luke, Republican State Senator Mary Felskowski supports allowing medical marijuana and issued a statement saying she's disappointed the state would run the dispensaries and says that she's a firm believer that private entities are more efficient and more effective than any government agency. Do you see potential problems with government-run dispensaries?
Yeah, that's a really interesting opinion. And yes, I mean, there's certainly arguments to be made about the red tape involved with government-run dispensaries. And, I was struck actually by this part of the bill, I mean, because it seems to depart a little bit from, a free enterprise ethos, the idea that Republicans are going to have a centralized state-run kind of program as apart from essentially allowing industry to handle this. That was intriguing to me. And I guess another thing, if I can, is with the bill as it's been proposed, it seems a little restrictive, again, in only allowing medical cannabis for certain conditions, 15 some conditions. I've read a lot about conservatism and conservative orthodoxy, and this idea of Trump's right to try, we're giving patients the option of taking a medicine to help them as they see fit, as long as they have the support of medical professionals. That sort of resonated with me. And again, it seemed a bit of a departure from this bill.
Would 5 dispensaries, would that be enough to meet the needs of all Wisconsin residents?
Well, I think the answer is no. I think the answer also is that there's room for expansion in the future. And it seems to me that there, the 5 would grow in number over several years. It also seems to me that, residents of the state, if they were in need of medical cannabis for medical purposes, that, 5 would probably be problematic for them, that they would need mm-hmm. to go elsewhere beyond the state to an adjacent state. And so, it seems like the number is more of a pilot than anything else.
In our final seconds together, what research are you watching for in this area of medical marijuana?
Well, I'm tracking pretty closely some state polls. I'm very interested in public opinion around medical cannabis and also personal use cannabis. And then beyond that, Kate, I'm really interested to see how implementation at the state level impacts federal level.
Luke, thank you so much for joining us.
It's always a pleasure talking to you.
Luke Rickert is a UW-Madison Pharmacy School professor and executive director of the American Institute of the History of Pharmacy. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Lenders use credit scores to decide whether to offer you a mortgage or a car loan. Landlords may use this three-digit number to decide who gets to rent their apartments. And new research reveals how mothers with low incomes view credit scores in the system of creditworthiness. Call in with a question, share thoughts, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Sarah Halpern-Meekin is a professor in the School of Human Ecology and La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. Sarah, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. And Michael Collins, professor of public affairs and human ecology at UW-Madison. Michael, welcome back as well.
Thank you. Appreciate being here.
Well, let's start with you. You surveyed 72 low-income mothers with a median age of 27, mostly identifying as either Black or Hispanic. What are you learning from this group of people?
So we were doing in-depth interviews because we wanted to really learn a lot about how moms approached managing their money. And one of the things that just was coming up in some of our early conversations was around credit scores. And so we decided we really needed to go back and ask specifically about that because it was clearly important to moms. So they were often struggling to make ends meet, but still thinking about credit. So we wanted to learn more about that. We asked them specifically about how credit impacted their lives. And we heard stories from moms about how they were really aware of having credit scores, whether those were good or bad. And that was a component of their lives that they thought about as they looked to a brighter future. So wanting to build up credit scores so that they could do those sorts of things you mentioned, rent an apartment more easily, maybe one day buy a house, get better terms, you know, on cell phone service. And they found it really difficult to do because of how that system is set up, but that didn't lead them to give up on making those efforts.
And Michael, a bit more visibility here on these 72 mothers that are part of a long-term study. How might credit scores fit into like larger research questions about equity and what you're learning about mothers with limited financial circumstances?
Yeah, I think broadly, we can just think about the fact that our financial system is designed for people who have more affluence, who have regular income, who have assets, who have wealth. And, you know, for people who don't have regular incomes and don't have any assets or wealth, they can sometimes get kind of left behind. And it doesn't mean that the credit score isn't as important to them. In fact, while the system wasn't designed with them in mind, the ability to borrow, say, to buy a car, is critical. That's what allows you to get to work. And so it's, you know, credit is sort of an essential building block of people's financial capability. And this system, you know, for most of us works pretty well. But when you're sort of on the fringe of the system, when maybe you don't have many accounts, maybe you're not banked, it's a little tougher to navigate this system. Yet we find these low-income moms are persevering. They're pretty resilient and they're finding ways to make it work for them.
Yes, Sarah, you found the people surveyed do not reject the credit scoring system's legitimacy. Did that surprise you?
We thought it was possible that they would say, hey, the deck is stacked against me. Why should I even try? And that was not mostly how they responded. They mostly felt like they faced tough trade-offs, but they really wanted better lives for themselves and their children. And in our society, one of the ways you get those is through having a decent credit score so that you can, you know, help your kids go to college and you can get insurance and all of those sorts of things. So they didn't give up on it even when it felt hard to get ahead.
Kelly wrote in to say that landlords can check someone's credit score before they decide to rent to someone. But if a renter pays the rent, it still does not help improve their credit rating. It's almost like, Kelly says, the credit system was created to keep poor people poor. I want both of you to respond to that. Michael, you first.
Yeah. You know, I don't know about the motivations of the people behind the credit scoring system. It's been, 60, 70 years since these credit bureaus and credit scoring systems were sort of put in place. But it is true that only certain kinds of credit behavior counts, quote unquote, counts in the credit bureau system. So it's payments on credit cards and things like that. Now, it is also true, I mean, if you did not pay your rent on time and that ended up in a court action where there was, you know, some sort of a dispute over the non-payment, that might actually end up in the credit score. But the positive payments of rent don't show up in the credit bureau reports and therefore aren't reflected in the credit score. There are some experiments right now to try to help landlords to do this reporting to the bureau so that those positive payments can be included, but it's still pretty rare. And a lot of landlords are pretty small and don't have a lot of capacity to do this. And unfortunately, the smallest, you know, least capacity landlords tend to be those that rent to the lowest income tenants. So it continues to be an issue. And, you know, for sure, there is a lot of aspects of the credit scoring system, which were not well designed for people who are sort of on the fringe of the financial system.
Sarah, what comes up for you in Kelly saying that the credit system is like created to keep poor people poor?
Kelly's, you know, point makes me think about some of the moms talking about the ways that they saw credit scores affecting them. So as I mentioned, in getting access to affordable cell phone service or internet service, in the kinds of insurance policies they could buy. And it also makes me think about, you know, we have varying laws state to state that say that employers can check credit scores when making hiring decisions. So we can sort of see how credit scores infuse themselves throughout people's lives, not just, you know, when they're making decisions about what to put on a credit card or not.
We're discussing credit scores with two authors of a recent study, Sarah Halpern-Meekin and Michael Collins, professors at UW-Madison. And you can join in. Questions and comments are welcome at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Michael, can you step back and give us more context about credit scores and the different standards? Like, not all lenders have the same, view these scores the same. I mean, can you explain what's behind this number?
Yeah, I mean, the genesis of all this is that, you know, starting even back in the 1950s, local creditors, lenders, even retail stores were extending credit to people. And then they would realize certain people weren't paying on time. And then that person would go to another lender or store and take out a line of credit and not pay. And so they formed these community credit bureaus where they would start sharing information and say, oh, you know, Bob Smith didn't pay me. You should beware of Bob Smith. And that sort of evolved into what became our credit reporting system. We now have three major credit bureaus in the US. And back in the late 1980s, the financial institutions that were trying to make decisions based on the credit bureau data said it would be a lot easier instead of having to call through all this information if we had just a single score. And that was where the Fair Isaacs Corporation created the FICO score, which is the score a lot of people have probably heard of. There are other scores out there too. There's Vantage and some others, but you know, generally they're trying to summarize people's credit worthiness on a scale, and that scale runs from, you know, roughly 500. It could be as low as 300, but most of what we see in the data is people in about 500 up and through 800, or a little bit higher. So, you know, that scale then becomes a threshold, and if you're not above a certain number, then lenders either won't give you credit or they'll charge you a lot more. A much higher interest rate for that credit. So that can be costly. On a mortgage, A difference between a 700 and a 500 credit score could be tens of thousands of dollars in interest that you would pay over the life of that loan. So it can have a pretty profound impact on people's ability to get credit and their affordability of credit.
And Sarah, what is the latest research on how the credit scoring system negatively affects people of color and people with low incomes?
So we know that people of color, women, parents with young children are disproportionately likely to have lower incomes for a variety of systemic reasons. And when you have a lower income, you are also likely to have a lower credit score. And so that then has those cascading effects that Michael was just talking about. There are discussions, as Kelly alluded to in her comment, about whether there are ways we could count alternative sorts of payments to factor into people's credit scores. So there's been some discussion in the research and sort of policy stakeholder arenas about whether doing credit scoring differently could do less to disadvantage people who are more on the financial margins.
Do you think it could? Do you think it could make a difference?
I think for some people it could, but what we saw from the moms who we were interviewing, sometimes they faced hard trade-offs between, say, making sure there was food on the table for their kids and the lights were on, and letting, an internet bill go unpaid for a month, or letting a cell phone bill go unpaid for a month. So often with a really limited income or instability in income, those trade-offs come. And so even if we were to count, some of the basic utility payments or rent payments, sometimes moms feel like they need to be late on those because there are things that are more important, like making sure their kids don't go to bed hungry that night. And so for those moms who are really in tough financial situations, those trade-offs they face would still end up negatively affecting their credit scores.
UW-Madison professors Sarah Halpern-Meekin and Michael Collins, new findings on how mothers with low incomes interact with the credit scoring system in America. And you can be part of the discussion along the way. Call in with a question, share your views at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Credit scores are key to accessing bank loans and financial mobility, and a pair of UW-Madison professors have new findings on how mothers with low incomes relate to the credit scoring system in America. Sarah Halpern-Meekin is a professor in the School of Human Ecology and La Follette School of Public Affairs, and Michael Collins, professor of Public Affairs and Human Ecology. Call in with a question, share your views, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Let's bring in Jeff in Appleton. Jeff, hi, what's on your mind?
Hi, just been listening briefly. I'm not sure where artificially inflated credit score really helps. A credit score just gives access to more debt. If debt hasn't been managed, more debt is not the answer. I would love to find an answer to the problem. And I'd love to see everyone succeed, but I don't see where more debt for people that haven't managed it well at this point is really an answer.
Jeff, thank you for that. Sarah, what do you make of that perspective?
It reminds me of some of the things we heard from some of the moms who said, I'm worried about using credit or spending money I don't have. They talked about the kinds of financial lessons and values they wanted their kids to learn. And those were about not spending beyond your means. And as Jeff speaks to, sometimes using credit and doing the things that actually help you build credit, your credit score, and expand how much credit you can have access to, or things that involve taking on debt, which mothers were often wary about because they knew their incomes were low sometimes and sometimes unstable.
I wonder, Michael, did the mothers know how to obtain a credit report and find out their credit score from the reporting agencies? How accessible was the score?
Yeah, that's a great question because I think there's been a pretty big shift in the both the branding of credit scores and also access to credit scores over about the last 10 years. So we should be clear that the credit scores that lenders use are very particular. Those are proprietary scores that the lenders pay for, and we typically don't see as consumers, unless, I mean, there is a provision in the law that allows you to see it if you're denied credit. But for most of us, we don't see the scores that lenders use, but we can see these so-called educational scores or the facsimile scores that are provided. Many banks provide them to their customers, many credit unions, credit card providers, and others. And then there are services where you can find your simulated credit score based on your credit bureau data. So they're much more accessible than they used to. And we found that most of the moms we talked to weren't necessarily, diligently tracking their scores and getting access to their score on a regular basis, but they knew generally where they were at. And based on some other data we looked at, it turns out that for a lot of low-income people, like the moms in our study, they actually underestimate how good their score is. So, there's also some uncertainty about what people think their score is, and so as a result, they think that their credit's worse than it really is.
Oh, that's really interesting. I mean, Sarah, it also you think about how much of a priority it is for them even to know their score when they're trying to do much bigger things like keep food on the table and the daily stresses of life with not being able to pay all your bills.
I think it really speaks to how fundamentally important credit scores are, that it is something that mothers are aware of. In our study, around 9 out of 10 of the mothers had an awareness of around what their credit score was. And that really underlines how much people know that it can shape what their financial options are in the moment and as they look ahead to what they'd like to work toward financially for their families.
We're hearing from Austin and Madison, called in to say there's a company called RentTrack that would report positive rent payments to credit agencies. And Austin says that was how they were able to improve their credit score that way. Do you have insights there, Michael, on RentTrack?
Yeah, I think that's an example of some of these new new innovative services that are out there. And to the extent that the struggle is that the landlords who are willing to do this may not be the landlords that rent to the very lowest income. But for people who pay on time, who have the option to sort of opt in and have the ability to have their positive rental payments reported, it can actually help them to start to build a credit record. So those services can be really valuable. But they're not universally available, and they're probably the least likely to be available for the really low-income moms that we talked to in this study.
Sarah, the Biden administration is proposing to omit medical debt from the credit scoring system. Would that step improve credit for people with low incomes?
I think it depends on what group of people we're talking about. Often, the people with some of the very lowest incomes have Medicaid, and so many of their health insurance bills are covered, especially children are likely to be covered by Medicaid when their families have very low incomes. So discounting medical debt is less likely to help them than those folks who are just a little bit above them, who, especially in states that have an expanded Medicaid access, because those folks are less likely to be insured and therefore more likely to have medical debts.
That makes sense. Sarah Halpern-Meakin there, Michael Collins, they're professors at UW-Madison as we discuss credit scores and authors of a recent study on the subject. You can join in questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Want to ask both of you, how do you hope this research influences public policy to make credit scores and the financial system at large more equitable? Michael, you first.
Well, I think one of the unique things that I think this study does, and I really credit Sarah and Jill Hoyting and Melody Harvey, who are also co-authors on this, for leading the charge on this, is actually just listening to the voices of the consumers. So much policy is made based on big data, surveys, what's put out from industry groups. And the voice of the consumer is often very lost in all that. And so I think one of the important things about this study is just that we did listen. We didn't come in talking to these women about our assumptions about how the credit scoring system works. We listened to what they said. And what we heard suggests that there's some things that can be made better about this system. But this system is something that they're working with and they're working through. And so I think that's a particular perspective that I hope policymakers can take into account as they think about new regulations in this space.
When you listened to their stories, had any of the people you surveyed ever disputed something on their credit report, pushed back on it?
That wasn't something that came up often. So moms were typically trying to do what they can in their power to raise their credit scores, like Austin mentioned, using some of the new services or apps that say they can help you build your credit. Those were the sorts of things that the strategies moms focused on.
Those new technologies, those apps, Sarah, do they hold promise?
Some of the moms felt that they did. I remember talking to one mom who was telling us that she had been using one of these apps to pay herself, which is how the app described it. You would sort of pay yourself each month, and that would help to boost your credit score. She had a child and needed to go on maternity leave, which was unpaid because we don't have paid leave in the United States. And she then couldn't keep paying herself. So she saw that kind of progress she had made through using this app fall away because she had had a child.
Where does this research take you next, especially with these mothers?
So we're following these moms over time and trying to learn about a whole lot of different things from them. Some of the things that we're working on right now are trying to understand how they anticipate and try to prepare for financial shocks that they might experience ahead, like losses of income or unexpected expenses, and trying to understand more about the kinds of ideas around financial comfort or financial stability that they are motivated to work toward. And so, as Michael mentioned, really just listening to the mothers and having their perspectives guide the kinds of questions we
Where
ask
you
and the
take it
answers.
next. Yes, Sarah Halpern-Meakin, Professor, School of Human Ecology and La Follette School of Public Affairs. J. Michael Collins, Professor of Public Affairs and Human Ecology at UW-Madison. Find a link to the study, wpr.org/mornings. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Farmland preservation agreements are growing in Wisconsin. The state agriculture department cites more than 1.6 million acres now designated agricultural enterprise areas, with portions of two additional counties, Green Lake and Sauk, now part of the program to protect land, soil, and water. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Todd Morris is in the central part of the state, county conservationist for Green Lake County Land and Conservation Department. Todd, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yes, and Brad Robson is here, conservation agronomist for Monroe County in southwest Wisconsin. Brad, welcome.
Yes, good morning, Kate and Todd, and thank you for having this show on the radio.
Thank you, Brad. Let's start with you. Monroe County has more than 83,000 acres dedicated to the state's Agricultural Enterprise Area program. What does this farmland designation mean?
The opportunity to advance protections of our local farmlands to keep that in productive ag land use. And the opportunity for us to work with our local landowners and operators to implement the best management practices on those agriculture lands are the biggest things I feel it brings to to Monroe County and our residents.
And you have a longer lens on this, Brad. Monroe County joining the state's program in 2014, a decade now. What type of farming operations are you seeing that exist on these lands?
Monroe County is a very diversified agriculture area. We have everywhere from, we have a large Amish community in our area who are mainly small farms and laborers, and all the way up to, we do have a number of CAFOs, large dairy units, in our county, and they all seem to work together quite well. And then when you get to the north of our county, we actually have a large area of cranberry growers in Monroe County. So we have quite a diverse agricultural background in our county. So it's a great opportunity to work with those landowners and operators for us.
And Todd, turning to Green Lake County, in the first year of this agricultural enterprise area program, what inspired the county's participation?
So really it was landowners' involvement. Landowners contacted our department, said they were interested in developing the ag enterprise area. So we kind of helped them through the process to get the petition developed and put off to DATCAP for approval.
And what is behind this petition? How does that work?
So the petition process is basically about now. Usually in January is when we start, if landowners are interested, start having a couple meetings. And we try to hold them in the areas where that, obviously, we're having the ag enterprise area interest. Hold a few meetings to just let landowners know what an ag enterprise area is. Specifically in Green Lake County, two of our three ag enterprise areas were in non-zoned townships. So they really didn't have a whole lot of involvement with the county as far as zoning or even our department. So this was kind of a new thing to them to be working with the county to develop the process. So we started off having meetings, generating interest, working with there was a couple landowners that really spearheaded the project that got it going. We worked with them to kind of spread the news and gain some more support for the AAU.
What has come up at meetings? What are people expressing?
Specifically, when we were unzoned, it was kind of like a zoning issue. They thought maybe this was some way to kind of regulate zoning, to regulate land use on there. It's not any of that. I mean, it still remains cropland or unzoned. I mean, it's not a zoning issue.
Mm-hmm.
So that was our main issue in the unzoned townships, is that this was some kind of way that maybe the local government wanted to put zoning on the area.
We're discussing Wisconsin's Farmland Preservation Program. We have area conservationists Todd Morris of Green Lake County. Brad Robson is here of Monroe County. You can join in with questions and comments about these agricultural designations. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Brad, Monroe County expanding its protected agricultural area by 20,000 acres this year. Why is this expansion underway?
Again, Kate, like Todd had mentioned, this is truly a bottom-up approach to protecting and preserving our farmland in the area. Again, it starts from landowners being interested in this program. And again, like Todd said, we had, with our original programs, we had a couple of landowners that spearheaded the operation. It's up to them to, you know, get the interest in the area, collect signatures. You know, obviously the land conservation departments in the areas work with them, but it's truly built from the ground up. And that's what's nice about it, is the landowners and operators are the ones that actually want to protect their land. So that's the biggest benefit we can see of it all.
Protect their land. How much of a threat is development to Wisconsin farmland, taking acreage out of production?
It's a big threat. Nationally, we lose 5,000 acres a day to development. And then you start bringing that down to the local level, and it's a challenge. And you can see it as you drive by in the areas. Monroe County is sort of unique. We do have two interstate systems that run through the area, so commercial development is a concern simply because of ease of access. So that's part of the ideas of this thought process is if we can protect our farmlands currently and keep that in production, we're all better off and it's better managed that way, we believe.
Todd, what are your thoughts from Green Lake County on these designations? Are they enough to guard against farmland being redeveloped into something other than agriculture?
I think it's a start. I do like them for the fact that they are local and they are brought by the local people. So in a couple of our areas, supporting local agricultural economy was a goal that we've had in those agricultural enterprise areas. So we've had larger farmers, too, that are mainly row crop, corn, grain, wheat. But we've also had smaller, fresh vegetable market type landowners that are also interested in it. So it's really a way to protect all phases of agriculture. And it's been very well received, and I think it's a good start to limit the conversion to farmland. Once you get the ag enterprise area, you still have to sign an agreement for 15 years that says it's going to stay in ag, and that's where I think you get the protection of the cropland for at least 15 years.
At least 15 years. What do you think of that type of timeline? There, between like 15 years and last month, Governor Evers signing a bill into law lowering the minimum term length for these agreements from 15 to 10.
Yeah, so it just was passed here, this last year, so that did drop down to 10. Every current one we have is 15. I think the 10 years is good. It's still a 10-year protection. My thought is just with working with a few that we've had worked with, that they would probably renew after the 10 years, even after the 15, I think. So a lot of them, their long-term goal is to keep that land as farmland. So, for them, it's forever, not just 15 years or 10 years. It's forever, and they want to really transition that farm to the next generation of farmer, and this is a way to help do that.
Todd Morris, County Conservationist for Green Lake County Land and Water Department. Brad Robson, Monroe County's Conservation Agronomist. Be part of this discussion about farmland preservation and land use. Call in with a question, share thoughts, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn about farmland preservation goals in Wisconsin and the growth of agricultural enterprise areas that utilize a tax credit to help encourage farmers to meet soil and water conservation standards. Be part of the discussion. Call in with a question. You can add your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Todd Morris is here, County Conservationist for Green Lake County Land and Water Conservation Department. Brad Robson, Conservation Agronomist for Monroe County. Brad, let's go further into these agreements. Landowners who have an agricultural enterprise area, they're eligible to enter these voluntary farmland preservation agreements. What does this agreement say?
Yes, and I would like to reiterate your voluntary on this. This is not coming from the top down. I know we're leaning on that heavy, but it is led by the landowner and producers. It's their option to do this. It's not mandated. Simply stated is just they are agreeing to follow best management practices on their ag land operations, whether it's themselves running it or a renter or operator of it, which really brings some control back to some of the landowners who choose to rent out their land or lease it out to a neighboring farmer. It just ensures they're doing the right things for the soil and for the environment in the time coming. So it's a great way to have some control over how your land is operated. If you're a landowner, if you're an operator, generally we're doing the right things anyway, but it brings you a little bit of added tax credit bonus back for thanking you for doing the right thing.
And this added tax credit type bonus for doing the right thing, the new law raises the dollar amount that can be claimed annually. So instead of receiving $5, an acre landowners can receive $10 per qualifying acre under this preservation agreement. How do you feel about this increase, Brad?
Well, we're thankful that DATCAP listened on this. They had sent out a survey in 2018, and those were two of the biggest issues on there. Was number one, the term of the agreement, which was holding people back, the term length of 15 years, and the payment was realistically too small to encourage participation. Now, we don't want to say it's just because of the money, and it's not, because people are doing it for the right thing. But it does take some time and paperwork and effort on their part. So we were very excited to see this term limit reduced and payment increased. And we would like to thank DATCAP and the representatives for introducing that and getting it passed. We feel it brings some more interest to the program.
Todd, what do you think of the tax credit for farmland preservation and its impact as you see it?
I agree with Brad. I mean, it's something that we've been looking to get increased. It's been, like I said, that was the main, if they sent out a survey, that was one of the things that was too low. So, and we've heard that at the local level here at our Land Conservation Committee's meetings, is that they're, for one of the requirements of, to stay, the agricultural standards is having a nutrient management plan and annually updating that. And some guys are going, the $5 an acre wasn't enough for me to worry about it, but the 10 is worthwhile. So I think it's a good increase, and we supported that. So, yeah, I think it's a really good, it's a good thing.
And so with the credit requiring the farmer to be in compliance with state and soil, water conservation plans and standards, who is ensuring the compliance?
So that falls onto the county land conservation department. So if a landowner signs an agreement that says they want to participate, our staff will go out there, we'll do a walkover, meet with the farmer, walk over his land, see if there's any erosion issues out there. We'll work with them to develop a conservation plan for the farm to ensure that it's meeting the tolerable soil loss, which is a requirement of the program. We'll also help them develop a nutrient management plan if they need it, or they may be working with somebody already to do that. So we're just making sure that plan meets the state standards or the NRCS standards. The conservation department really is the one that's tasked to do that. Once they, if we determine that they meet it, we'll issue them what's called a certificate of compliance, and that's what they get take to their tax preparer that says, yep, the Tony's been out here, we're meeting the program requirements, and we're eligible to claim that tax credit.
Brad, does that systematic walkthrough determination, does that seem to be able to make this tax credit do what it's supposed to do?
Yes, it does. That's a great opportunity for, like Todd said, the local land conservation departments to get on the farmland, on the farms, meeting with the landowners, doing a walkover and just talking through them with them about what's going on the property. And we feel here that, the more times we can be on the land with the landowner and operator, the better we can do for the soil and the environment. The protections downstream, I think, are really an added bonus to this. It's not just on the farmland itself, but the rivers and streams downland are very important to us. So if we can do a better job managing nutrients, managing soil loss, that's a win for the whole community and beyond, we feel.
But communication is key, that really face-to-face, those meetings and talking with the farmers is really essential is what I'm hearing.
Yes. The face-to-face, putting a person to it, getting there, really talking through what's required, what's needed for the program, and the it gives us the opportunity to discuss the actual benefits of why we're doing this and why we need to preserve our farmland. Again, I go back to the development happening, and it's real, even out here in Monroe County. It's, you start looking around, and it's a way for landowners and farmers to protect that ag land, because we all know we need this ag land in production and for the future.
Talking about Wisconsin's Farmland Preservation Program, Brad Robson there of Monroe County, and County Conservationist Todd Morris with us as well in Green Lake County. You can join in with questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Jeff is wondering about how much conservation practices are being used in these zones. Like, farming has become so industrialized, Jeff says. Does this program prevent unsustainable or farming practices that are polluting? Todd, what are your insights there?
So I guess conservation is also no-till, reduced tillage, and nutrient management. So that's where we always start, is with that conservation plan. So even if you're a larger farmer, still having that conservation plan in place to make sure that, you know, your soil is not eroding more than the tolerable soil loss, or that would be allowed to be made productive. So, you know, our goals are kind of the same with the farmers. You know, we want to make sure that land keeps producing. You know, we don't want to be, you know, eroding it more than it, you know, so that it's not productive anymore. So even with larger farmers, there's still opportunity with reduced tillage, no-till nutrient management, along with a suite of other best management practices. Mm-hmm. We do a lot of grass waterways, a lot of sediment basins or grade stabilization structures in our county, which slow the water down. And we've done them with large, small, all farmers. The main thing, like Brad said, is really just talking, you know, if somebody's operating their land or renting their land out to an operator, talking with that operator so that everybody's on the same goal. I mean, the landowner has goals, so does the operator, and so do we. So just as long as we're all on that same page, we can get the conservation done.
I wonder, Todd, hypothetical here, but what would, without this tax credit, this preservation farmland credit, what would happen to farmland in Wisconsin, do you think?
So in our area, what we're seeing is, I mean, we don't have a lot of big development, but we're seeing smaller parcels sold off. So we're seeing this fragmentation of it. So the 40 acres is now 35 with a house here, and you know, maybe another house on the other side, and especially in an unzoned where, you know, the county doesn't have any minimum requirements on lot sizes, we're seeing more farms, you know, or more farms getting broken up and going into non-farm uses with non-farm backgrounds to them, and that sometimes causes conflicts with people not knowing what farmers do on the land and what they, you know, planting-wise, manure management-wise, and stuff like that. Sometimes it causes some concerns and issues.
Brad, as we wrap up here, Wisconsin having more than 1.6 million acres now in these designated agricultural designations, do you see that growing in the future?
Yes, I do. Yes, I truly do see that. I think we're at a point now that we realize we do need to do something and protect our ag land use that we have. The advantage to this is, I guess one thing we didn't touch on quick is the actual landowner decides how much of the property they get to put in. Mm-hmm. If they think, you know, their son or daughter is going to want to move back and build a house on one section of it, they can exclude that in the terms of the contract.
There is that flexibility. I want to thank you both for joining us. Brad Robson, conservation agronomist, Monroe County in southwest Wisconsin. Todd Morris, County Conservationist for Green Lake County Land and Water Conservation Department in the central part of the state. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. A college program helps Wisconsinites quickly get up to speed on the different skill sets and business operations of running a dairy. It's called the Farm and Industry Short Course, and it's been a fixture in our state since the late 1800s. It's now being offered through UW River Falls. Call in with a question. Share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Steve Kelm is a UW River Falls Dairy Science Professor and Chair of the Animal and Food Science Department. Steve, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thank you for having me.
Well, give us a taste of what students are learning as the program started in October, runs into March. What are they learning?
So the intent of the Farm and Industry Short Course, when it was started at UW-Madison over 100 years ago, was to give continuing education opportunities for individuals that are going into agriculture. And so it covered a fairly broad range of programs as it went through the years at Madison. As we moved it to River Falls, we've focused on the dairy industry because of its legacy and importance in the Wisconsin economy. And so we just finished up the fall semester. And so students had seven different courses, the courses carried with them college credits. And so some example would be milk quality, a dairy techniques course where individuals are doing hands-on things such as learning how to give IVs, learning how to evaluate lameness, things like that. They also had courses in dairy cattle nutrition and a introduction to business and accounting.
Why is the hands-on aspect something that you've really stressed? Why is that critical?
So I think that the hands-on, in particular, for the audience that is attracted to the Farm and Industry Short Course, it is a short, intensive education process. So it's 16 weeks. It's 7 weeks in the fall and 7 weeks in the spring, and then you add on some time in J term and other times. They really have a strong desire to understand things that will benefit their business, their operation that they're going back to right now. And so the hands-on with the animals or hands-on from a land or a plant base, it just enhances the learning so much because you just see the wheels turning and the questions pop up. Okay, how exactly does this relate to my business? How can I improve what I'm going back to? And I want to do it right now. Hmm. And so that's a big aspect here.
So you have the financial and business operational skill building, but also that the practical hands-on skills in the barn. I mean, is that helpful for students not to just specialize in one area, but to know a little bit about a lot of things?
Oh, 100%. I think we really have to always think about individuals that are, you know, in dairy farms. I mean, it's kind of old hat to talk about that they have to be viewed as a business and things like that. You know, I think you have to view dairy farmers as entrepreneurs. And so just like any entrepreneur, whether you're owning a farm or owning a restaurant or owning a grocery store, anything like that, you have to have kind of the technical skills, which kind of drew you into it in the first place. But you have to have a background in whether it's business or kind of other things. In our case, it's things in agronomy or things in, I know your previous guest was talking about land and manure management. There has to be some additional emphasis on those areas for individuals to be successful.
Are there any aspects of this coursework delivered online?
Our work in terms of the transitioning from Madison to River Falls has been residential.
Okay.
And face-to-face offerings. Now, that could change in terms of, we certainly have had requests from individuals that can't be there, and are there opportunities to put some of this in an online format? We're kind of taking the approach right now, Kate, as it's our we just finished that first semester. You kind of have to crawl before you walk, and then you walk and then you run. And mm-hmm. so it's kind of a gradual process, kind of as we transition the program up here.
I would imagine it can, that residential component of it could be a barrier for some people who want to go through this short course, and yet that commitment of being on site, you know, each day of the program, that could be certainly something that, you know, people can't do.
Yeah, it can be. I mean, I agree. And there are where other individuals where that is a barrier, we've tried to recommend them to some programs or at least some classes that maybe a remote delivery opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one thing I didn't mention, Farm and Industry Short Course still has some offerings through UW-Madison. So, for example, an online opportunity that's gone for a number of years is utilizing Spanish in the dairy workplace. And there will be some continue as Farm and Industry Short Course kind of evolves on that campus also. I would envision some additional online opportunities there and here and potentially at UW-Platteville as time goes along.
We're talking about dairy-focused farm and industry short course being offered now at UW-River Falls. Steve Kelm chairs the university's Animal and Food Science Department. You can join in questions and comments along the way, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. So last summer, a pair of bills introduced in the Assembly and Senate that would fund operating costs for UW-River Falls for the short course. What is the status of that funding?
So the funding, we've had hearings in both houses of the legislature. In terms of the actual vote on the bill providing operational costs, that has yet to come up okay. as a vote on the floor.
Okay, so you're still watching that. Yeah.
So, yeah, at this point, we've, you know, been operating on, you know, utilizing local resources. We've been, you know, certainly able to make it through on the teaching side. Thankfully we've got individuals that are very dedicated, educators, that I see a lot of value in this program and in the people that we're working with.
So when UW-Madison officials ended the program, saying the program, and you know, in 2022 because of low enrollment numbers, why UW-River Falls? Like, what happened with you or other campus member to say, hey, let's step up here, let's continue this?
Well, UW system is unique in that there's three campuses that have significant programming in agriculture. So to have programming at UW-Madison as the land grant, but also to have significant programming at UW-River Falls and UW-Platteville is really an opportunity that Wisconsin has that many states don't.
Hmm.
Our 4-year programs within our college is the College of Agriculture, Food, and Environmental Sciences. In fall of 23, we had just over 1,200 undergraduates in the College of Agriculture in CAFEs. That's a significant presence in terms of undergraduate education. That means because of the history with that, we have faculty that are experts in a field. We have a university farm, two university farms, to be honest, that I are very close to campus. I within the building where my office is, and literally 200 feet from where the students' dorms are, I is a brand new renovated dairy processing plant, creamery, and a meat processing plant. And so there were a lot of things that were in that made UW River Falls a good fit. I think that, you know, because we've had a number of individuals, alumni, that they were interested in us taking it on. There was certainly interest from Farm and Industry Short Course alumni to see it continue in a residential capacity. And we've gotten just tons of support from those individuals that see this particular campus, you know, right now today as a good fit for the program.
Steve Kelm is a UW River Falls dairy science professor, our guide to a longstanding certificate program in Wisconsin to quickly build skills in farm operations. And you can call in with a question. You can share your perspective, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We discuss the role of short college courses for new and beginning farmers and the impact of this educational model on Wisconsin's dairy industry. UW River Falls now offers the Farm and Industry Short Course after it was ended by UW-Madison. It's been running for nearly 140 years. Call in with a question. Share your perspective. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have Steve Kelm with us, UW River Falls dairy science professor. Steve, we heard from Jane in Dane County, called in to say that Jane's father took the short course in 1956 and then became a butter maker and was able to support his family with this job. What do you think of stories like this? What do they tell you?
Oh, goodness. We hear dozens of stories similar to that, and I'd love to hear those stories. Short course, in terms of individuals that have gone through and are alumni from the program, you know, they've gone on to, I mean, they're the individuals that they have a critical role in the dairy industry. They're farm owners and managers. They are individuals that are in the community. They're active on school boards and community boards and co-op boards. There's so much appreciation that I have for that alumni base. A number of the students that we have in this first inaugural class have parents or other individuals that went through a short course initially. In fact, one individual, his great grandfather came through the program in 1920, and established, you know, incredibly successful ag operations in northern Wisconsin. So, in a lot of cases, there's just a lot of great legacy that's involved here.
Let's examine the economic headwinds in farming. How are you talking with students about farm bankruptcy?
Well, I think I'm not sure that we're addressing farm bankruptcy per se, aside from the fact that we have to establish, you know, basic business principles. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have to move from that standpoint of, what records and what accounting procedures need to be adapted? How do we utilize this information for balance sheets and profit and loss statements? And then it moves into enterprise planning. We don't try to do any kind of sugarcoating and saying that, boy, just because you're here, you're guaranteed to be successful. As we said, I mean, the comp the comparison is definitely, you know, entrepreneurs in, you know, any variety of businesses. And in some cases, there's things that you can control, whether it's business issues and other management decisions, but there's some things you can't control.
Yes.
And those things, we just have to, you know, do our best planning to deal with the down times as well as celebrate the good times.
Yeah, some of those larger forces might be the marketplace for milk and what you can get for your milk, or, you know, crop damage. And I'm wondering if students talk about those things candidly and what comes up.
Very candidly. I think that in a lot of cases, these individuals are they either grew up and hope to enter into a partnership or take over an existing operation, or they're working as an employee for an operation. Definitely a lot of conversation, particularly if they are looking at starting their own farm. Will there be processing capacity? I think that's one of the major questions that we do get is, will the Wisconsin industry and the dairy industry in the U.S. continue to develop processing capacity such that new farms can come online? There's always the discussion of price volatility on the inputs, and boy, that's a challenging scenario when you have weather can have so much impact, you know, on a particular market.
And when you look at the number of farms, the state agency overseeing agriculture reports are almost 6,000 dairy farms in Wisconsin, highest in the nation. Do you see the short course extending generational farming or creating new farm families?
I think both.
Okay.
I think what we see in our inaugural class here is an example of that. It ranges from individuals that, you know, they would be, if they have the opportunity to go back to their farm, they would represent, in some cases, it's a fifth generation that would be going back. And so, yes, I do see continuing that. There's also individuals that came in. We have a student that is looking at this as a second career. And he is working for a dairy operation right now. And I think if he has his, if things line up correctly, you know, he will be a new farm entering into the Wisconsin industry. So that's fantastic. And, you know, having skilled individuals as employees on farms or as farm owners, super critical.
We're talking about the dairy-focused farm and industry short course, which has a long tradition in Wisconsin, now being offered at UW-River Falls. Steve Kelm chairs the university's Animal and Food Science Department. You can join in with your questions, comments, your stories, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Steve, I don't know if this is going to make you cringe or not, but, you know, as we've been talking, is this like a crash course in dairy farming, or is that off base to say that?
I don't think it would be considered a crash course.
Okay.
I think that we've taken pieces of our four-year program, which is very successful, we have taken really kind of the what we would consider some of the most critical elements for success on a particular enterprise are offering that. But we're offering it in as much detail and depth for those critical topics as we would in, you know, our four-year program. I think what the distinction is, so in other words, we're not attempting to jam, you know, multiple years into a 14-week course or a 14-week program, because that just doesn't help anybody. If we can drill down to, okay, these are the most critical elements, and before individuals leave, we're darn sure that they know that they're comfortable with these topics, then I think we've done our job.
In our last minute together, how do you plan to measure the success now that the program has moved to your campus, UW-River Falls?
Well, I think that we will continue to monitor enrollment. Our inaugural class, we set a fairly modest target. And so in terms of the number of admits for next year, we're already at, and this is on, January 11th, we're at the number of admits for next year's class already in comparison to what we have right now. So we'll continue to monitor the growth. I think we really monitor it by the interaction that we continue to have with these individuals and what are they doing? I think that we want individuals to be successful in the dairy industry, be successful in any type of career that they choose when they leave here. And so I think, maintaining contact and walking through and, seeing where potential holes are and where we can fill those holes in.
Monitoring those outcomes.
And make the program better.
Yeah. Well, enjoyed the talk, Steve. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Steve Kelm is a UW-River Falls dairy science professor, chairs the Animal and Food Science Department there. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.